Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm Assistant Director for Special Collections in the MSU Libraries, and I would like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. This is our final reading for the semester, but we'll be back in the fall for another season of readings by prominent Michigan writers. We hope to see many of you again in the fall, and to that end, I'm going to be circulating, actually, it's not circulating, it's up here, a sheet for you to provide your name and email address so that we can contact you about upcoming readings. And now a little bit about our reading tonight and the Michigan Writers Series. As with all Michigan Writers Series events, the reading tonight will be taped and placed on the internet on the home site of the Michigan Writers Series hosted by the MSU Libraries. The reading tonight will last approximately 30 minutes, and afterwards there will be time for some questions. Books by tonight's author are on sale, and the author will sign books after the reading. And now I'd like to introduce to you our writer for tonight, Paul Clemens. Paul Clemens grew up in the northeast corner of Detroit, just south of the city's famed 8 Mile border. In his book, Made in Detroit, a South of 8 Mile memoir, Paul Clemens tracks his own growth to maturity against the background of the city's long decline. Since its publication midway through 2005, Made in Detroit has received much attention and created some controversy. For Made in Detroit is the story of a young man's education in the social and racial realities most writers would rather avoid. But it is also the story of a literary apprenticeship in the classic American mold. In addition to his youthful Catholicism, Paul Clemens acquired another belief in reading and writing, and he embraced the writer's vocation with enthusiasm. Made in Detroit is a story about being caught in the middle, about being white in a black city, urban in a suburban America, blue collar in an increasingly obsolete Rust Belt, and Catholic in a place where churches were closing at an unprecedented rate. Sparing no one, including himself, Paul Clemens depicts with authenticity and redemptive grace the realities of one city's and one family's recent history. Made in Detroit has received local and national praise. It is the 2005 Michigan Notable Book awarded by the Library of Michigan, the winner of the 2006 award for the best nonfiction work about the Great Lakes region awarded by the Center for Great Lakes Culture here at Michigan State University, and a notable 100 Book of the Year by the New York Times. Will you please join me in welcoming Paul Clemens to Michigan State University.
I would like to thank Dr. Berg and Michael Rodriguez for inviting me to come up here, and I would like to thank all of you for coming out. As I was driving up here from downtown Detroit after I got off work at 5, I drove through what felt like a hurricane to get here, and I figured that coupled with a Friday night at 8 o'clock reading time would make the crowd rather sparse. So again, I probably wouldn't have shown up if I wasn't the one reading, so I thank you all for coming out. I want to begin by saying things that I said a few moments ago when I did an interview with Michael Rodriguez, which is that I realized this is part of the Michigan Writers Series, and I'm not entirely sure that either of those words or that term describes me. Sort of like the Holy Roman Empire being neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. First of all, I'm not sure in what sense I'm a Michigan writer. I told Michael I've never been to the Upper Peninsula. I don't know most of the state. I know, you know, part of Detroit extremely well, more well than will ever be useful. And I know Grand Rapids fairly well, and I can name every exit on I-96 between Detroit and Grand Rapids. So, you know, I can tell you exit 84 is Eagle Westphalia. But that's about the extent of my knowledge of Michigan. I've said to people that, you know, people always say there's New York City and then there's the rest of the state of New York. I mean, I've always thought there's Detroit and then there's the rest of the state of Michigan. So I feel confident saying I'm a Detroiter, but I don't know in what, you know, sense I'm a Michigander. And I also don't know in what sense I'm a writer. I told Michael, and I don't mean this with any sort of false deference. I'm not a writer. I'm a guy who wrote a book, and I think there's a difference. I mean, I'm not working on anything at present. I don't have a book deal, another book deal. This was the book that, you know, I think had in me, and I hope to write again, but I don't know if I will. But you know, I know some writers, and they're writers to their bones. They eat and sleep it, and they can't not write. And I can gladly take it or leave it. You spend a lot of time staring at the screen of your laptop, and you often wonder, why am I doing this? So So even though I'm happy to be here as part of the Michigan Writer Series, that's my long disclaimer that I may or may not be a Michigan writer, but I'm happy to be here nonetheless. I was told to read for 30 minutes, and I explained that my day began at 6:30 this morning over in Detroit, and I'm sort of running on empty, so I might read for a little less than that. I'm happy to take questions when it's over. In fact, I tend to look forward to that more. So if any of you have read the book and have any questions, feel free to lob them my way. And I'm not going to read straight through either. I was telling some folks before we began that I've never gone to a reading where I haven't gotten bored. And that's usually because the writers read too long without a break. So I'm going to read different passages, none more than a couple of pages, and give a little bit of commentary as I go along. The first passage I'm going to read comes from a chapter that I entitled Cars and Catholicism. And for those of you who've read the book or even seen reviews of it, there are sort of themes, not to use that high school English word, but automobiles and cars, obviously, is one. My father, in many ways, is the main character in the book, and he's a car enthusiast, to put it mildly. And Catholicism is one of the themes of the book, and race, obviously. So I'm going to read this passage called Cars and Catholicism, and just to preface it, last summer I was notified by my publisher that the New York Times Magazine was going to run an excerpt of it. If those of you who get the Sunday Times, the back page of the Times Magazine is I think they call it the Lives column, and so it's like 900 words. It's not long, but it's a nice place to be when you have a book coming out, and so I felt very fortunate. And after my glee wore off, you know, how do you boil anything down to 900 words? I mean, those of you who write, that's three double-spaced pages with 12-point font. It's hard to say anything. I clear my throat in 900 words. So I had to think about what to use out of the book. How do I distill it into 900 words? And the section I chose, again, which I'll read in a moment, ponders the question, were we white trash, my family, growing up? And the reason I thought to pick that passage is this. Last year about this time, my eldest was taking a dance class. And it was Monday evenings, I think, and it was after work, 6 o'clock. So I would come home from work, and to give my wife a break, I would take my eldest to this ballet and tap class. And to give her an even better break, I would take our littlest with her, who, when the class began, was 8 or 9 months old. And so my wife would send me off with the, you know, the bag with the diapers and the bottle, and we'd always have, you know, a bag of Cheerios or crackers for the baby. And again, she was about 9 months old when the class started, so she was sort of just crawling around. And aside from me, it was almost entirely mothers. I was one of the only fathers there, and sometimes the only father there. And the mothers doted on this baby who they sort of saw grow up over the course of this 4 or 5 month class. And one mother in particular, who is an African-American woman, took a real shine to my baby. And you know how kids are. She would, you know, chew on the Cheerio or the cracker and then offer it to her as slimy. No thanks, sweetie. But, you know, she loved her, and they got along very well. And it became sort of a running joke between them. You know, what kind of cracker do you have today, sweetie? You know, and she would have the Ritz cracker or whatever. And so every week she would say, well, you know, what's the cracker this week? And so that went on for months. And by the time the class was over and the recital began, my youngest was walking. So the night of the recital, she put on her, you know, little dress and the party shoes, and I took her backstage to see the girls in their tutus. And this mother who I mentioned, she was one of the mothers backstage, sort of herding them. You know, you got a bunch of 5 or 6 year old girls running around crazy, you know, herding them on stage when their cue came up. And so I went backstage to show my little one, her big sister, and her friends. And the mother saw me back there with the little one. And I don't know if she forgot her name or what it was, or just there was so much confusion, but she saw me walk back there with her, and she said, oh, she said, there she is. There's that little cracker baby. And it's, when she said that, she had a look on her face like, what did I just say? And of course, I burst out laughing. I thought it was, you know, I thought it was hilarious, and I still do. And but that was in the back of my head, those sort of class issues in the white community. And one of the issues that, you know, was, well, you know, are we white trash? Are we not white trash? So this is a contemplation of that. And this is part of what got excerpted in the New York Times Magazine. Were we white trash? We were Catholics, first of all, ethnic Catholics on my mother's side, and it never seemed to me growing up that Catholics could be white trash. The terms were mutually exclusive, with Catholicism possessed of an imposing grandeur that distanced its practitioners from matters as perfunctory as the screaming, dirty-faced children that white trashdom carried under its crooked arm. To be white trash was to live a life of constriction, of intermittent paychecks bearing greasy thumbprints, while Catholicism was elevating, enlarging. As Catholics, we weren't white trash. We were working class. We worked while white trash sat on their asses, some mumbled nonsense coming out of their mouths always. Catholics had two parents in the house, while white trash children had mothers, along with enough extended relatives to make your head spin. White trash parents yelled at their kids to absolutely no effect. Their entire lives, in fact, were an exercise in pissing into the wind, an endless hokey pokey that, like the cars up on blocks in their driveway, would never get them anywhere. Catholicism, on the other hand, concerned itself with the last things, was teleological, as the priest taught me, and led its followers through a purposeful progression, from baptism to communion to confession to confirmation to matrimony to extreme unction, with eyes fixed firmly and forever on the afterlife. And yet there was good evidence of our families being white trash, with the incriminating details existing close enough to our basically responsible working-class Catholicism that it was difficult at times to distinguish between the two competing strains. "Hold still," my mother would say in the morning as she tried to, before school, to smooth down the cowlicks in my hair with a warm, wet rag. It was usually still dark when my father left for work, and often dark when he got home. So my mother saw to it that he received a formal send-off each morning, dragging my sister and me to the side door, the two of us still sleepy-eyed, to wave farewell. Beth held a rub-a-dub dolly to her chest with one arm as she waved goodbye with the other. After he'd gone, there was breakfast to be eaten and school uniforms to put on. Clothes that in the wintertime, my mother warmed in front of the heating vents in the living room so that I'd be twice burned by the metal on my corduroy pants. My fingertips were singed first as I snapped and zipped myself up, and then my lower belly would be reddened from contact with the pants top button. My sister wore a plaid skirt and white blouse, like all Catholic schoolgirls, and had no such problems. What sometimes preceded the waves and the warm clothes was wholly unworthy of the portrait of the well-functioning Catholic family that I've just painted. My father, for reasons known only to God and himself, was not averse to firing up before dawn this or that hot rod of his, and leaving it rumbling long enough in the garage to get a good look at the gauges. This was a length of time sufficient so that every soul within a several block radius, or so I imagine, sat bolt upright in bed, asking what the hell that was all about. Sometimes he actually took the car out, driving it slowly up and down the street so that it could stretch its legs. "I guess your dad took his car out this morning," the mother of a friend of mine with whom we carpooled said to me once on the way to school, a displeased smile on her reflection in the rearview mirror. I'm not sure, in fact, which was louder, the gingerly trip down the block out in the open air, or the reverb produced by a 400 horsepower 64 Chevelle at full throttle inside a cinder block garage. Now, that passage was not all excerpted in the Times, and I added other things to it to make the passage cohere, but it struck me as pretty innocuous. I mean, of all the prejudices you can have, anywhere, it seems to me prejudice against sort of low-class whites is acceptable somehow in polite company. So, and I meant it to be humorous as well. My sister, not too many years ago, we were both at my parents', and my father was trying to fill a hole in my parents' lawn. So he dumped a bunch of dirt in the hole, but there was this bump. So he got out a big piece of wood, put it over the bump, got in the car, and then took the car over the bump to, you know, so the weight would flatten it. And my sister looked at me and she just said, "So WT." And I just nodded my head. It's a term of endearment, I suppose, and it meant humorlessly. And I meant it humorously, not humorlessly. But the next week in the Times Magazine, there were two letters, I think, one from a guy in upstate New York and some guy from north of Fort Lauderdale somewhere in Florida, you know, chastising me for my use of the term. And I have to admit, I was taken aback, and someone asked me about that, and I said, "I suppose you can never underestimate the humorlessness of certain readers of the New York Times." But I meant it again as a term of endearment, and I should say, and I get this question, I'm probably taking somebody's question, that everyone in my family read this book before I sent it on to New York. So if anyone had any objections, there was a sort of a speak now or forever hold your peace moment. So my father had signed off on this. So, and my father, as I write about in the book, if you've read it, is a very working class fellow and very commonsensical. But he struck me as more insightful on this point than some of the respondents. He said, "Didn't they understand you were just playing around with stereotypes?" And it struck me as a very trenchant. I never thought I'd hear that phrase come out of my father's mouth, but it struck me as fairly trenchant because that's in fact exactly what I was trying to do. The next passage I'm going to read, if I can find it here. I'm sorry, I haven't done a reading in ages. I was actually supposed to come up here, I think, in January. And I apologize if any of you were planning on coming to that, and I had to reschedule, so I'm a bit out of practice. But the next passage I will read is the opening of the book, and there's about a 6 or 7 page car chase that opens the book, if you've read it. And this sort of, as I pondered how to begin the book, again, I knew that I wanted to write about cars, I knew I wanted to write about Catholicism and sort of the local color of growing up in Detroit. And I also had to grab the reader, right? You don't want to begin with a dull passage, so I figured this would work. And actually, that's not true. My editor thought it would work. I had about a 20-page preamble, and often it's the case, I think, when people write books that you spend 20 or 25 pages clearing your throat, and what you need is a good editor to say, chuck all of it, and the book starts here. And my editor rightfully said the book begins with your mother poking you in the ribs to wake you up, so... And he turned out to be correct. But this is a chapter called Right to Go Left, which gets its title from the Michigan left that's all over, which everyone around here understands, but most people in the country don't. So I had to spend a paragraph laying that out for folks. Paul, get up. This is my mother, shaking me awake around 3 a.m. on a midsummer night in 1989. Before being poked in the ribs, I had been sleeping with the violent soundness of a 16-year-old boy, and so had not, in my upstairs bedroom, heard the noise, a gunshot blast, that had awakened my parents downstairs. Me, turning away. What the hell, Ma? Her, pulling back the sheet. Paul, you've got to go after your dad. Me, sitting up. Jesus, what for? Some guys just shot out the window of our truck. Your dad went after them. They have a gun. Get up. Christ, where are my running shoes? Ever the organized housewife, even at the witching hour, she already had them in her hands, and as I too had the drill down cold by this point, such things tended to happen quite a bit in our corner of Detroit, I sleepily grabbed for the baseball bat that leaned against my bedpost for just such a purpose. The bat was an aluminum Easton, 32 inches in length and weighing 29 ounces, with a barrel, according to the bat's red lettering, 2.5 inches in diameter, the B5 Magnum. The model name struck me as an unfortunate misnomer, as it was not, in fact, a gun, which would have been more appropriate to the occasion. A gun was what my dad had, and so did the guys we were chasing. On the bedpost hung a rosary blessed in Rome by Pope Pius XII, which I ritually ran my fingers over before falling asleep. I did so for a second time before running downstairs. Though on past occasions I had had to give futile chase on foot, I was able, by 16, to hop in the car that I'd recently purchased with a combination of parental help and house painting money, my previous summer's earnings. I drove slowly at first, headlights off, stopping briefly in intersections to look up and down the dark side streets. After a minute or two of searching, I caught a glimpse a couple blocks up, toward 8 Mile Road, of the getaway car, which went streaking by. On its back bumper, with my father behind the wheel, was the chase car. They were both, I guessed, going about 70, and cars not manufactured to go much faster. 4-cylinder imports, theirs from Japan, my father's from Europe. But my father, who had raced go-karts, dune buggies, and dragsters for most of his adult life, was by far the better driver, able to get the most out of the little 5-speed that was used, by and large, by my mother to run errands. My father had amazed me throughout my childhood with his ability to spin 360s in icy intersections. It had something to do, I noticed, with violently jerking up the parking brake. And he remains the only person I know able to shift his way from first through fifth without his foot once touching the clutch. It's how the European rally drivers do it, he once told me. They never use their left foot. Their right heel is on the brake, and the ball of their right foot is on the accelerator. But how do you know where you can shift that way? Without using the clutch to disengage the gears, you mean? You can hear it when the gears mesh. Car performance and upkeep was everything to this man. When he purchased a new car, new to us, I mean, we bought used cars, the first thing my father did was pull out the air conditioner. All those damn things did was use up gas, drain off power, and make it more or less impossible to work on the engine when something went wrong, stuck as air conditioners were, smack in the middle of significantly more important components. "This is Michigan," he'd always say. 8 months out of the year, you don't need air conditioning anyway. Whom to obey where opinion diverges, mom or dad? My mother was always fond of pointing out that things, as she would have it, were replaceable, but that people were not. You can always buy another blank, but you could never, never replace so-and-so. This was mom's theory, often stated, and the reason that she'd awakened me in the first place, to be sure to bring her irreplaceable husband home alive. But my father's stance, which went stoically unstated, because self-evident, was somewhat different, and oddly enough, of a piece with that of my favorite philosopher at the time, who sang in that summer's inescapable song, "You can have anything you want, but you better not take it from me." That night, I sided with the old man and Axel. Instead of concentrating my efforts on calling off the chase, whatever that would have entailed, I joined in the pursuit, baseball bat, check, by my side. Despite many much better incentives to rejoin the battle, these summer car chases, perhaps half a dozen in all, would be my farewell to vigilantism, that unfairly criminalized response to widespread criminality. What with his white t-shirts, wiry build, and messy sideburns, my father looks, in family photo albums from the mid to late 70s, like every other young father of that era, which is to say, like Bruce Springsteen, on the back cover of Darkness on the Edge of Town. 10 years later, he had softened only slightly. Blessed with a helpful disposition and familiar with his hometown's every last alleyway, he could happily discuss directions in Detroit until doomsday. "Now remember," he said to many visitors over the years, as they put on their coats to leave, "at 8 Mile there, you're going to have to go right to go left." The phrasing of these directions was revealing of his worldview. Life is a list of things that you have to do. One of these on the major surface streets of Detroit is to go right to go left. This phenomenon is the so-called Michigan left, that traffic quirk that forces one, on busy boulevards particularly, to turn right initially in order to go left eventually. If you were to drive north on Kelly Road, an eastern divider between city and suburb, and wanted to turn left onto 8 Mile, the city's northern boundary, you would not, upon approaching the intersection, get into the left-hand turn lane, for the simple reason that there is no left-hand turn lane. There is a right-hand turn onto 8 Mile only, and those who would have liked to go left must employ the hairpin turnaround on the boulevard's far side, a full 4 lanes over, which occurs immediately after making the turn off of Kelly. No one from the rest of the country understands that anyways, but I had to put it in there. Should put a map in. A good deal more than just two streets converge at this intersection. If you had continued going east along 8 Mile instead of doubling back, you would quite quickly have entered into Grosse Pointe, the old, well-to-do suburb to the east of the city, along the banks of Lake St. Clair. You would, too, have remained in Wayne County, the oldest in Michigan, for which the city of Detroit, settled three centuries back by the French, is the county seat. By taking the turnaround to the westbound side of 8 Mile, you enter Macomb County, the working-class suburban enclave that, more than 20 years after first achieving national fame, still finds itself, every 4 years, beloved of pollsters and trackers of voting patterns. At the time of the Iranian hostage crisis, the gas shortages, and the Olympic boycotts, Macomb County was considered a national political trendsetter, an area in which large numbers of ethnic Catholics and unionized blue-collar workers decided to vote against Jimmy Carter in the 1980 presidential election. Such voters would later be labeled Reagan Democrats, would in fact constitute a movement, and the movement's epicenter was said to be located 5 blocks to our north in Macomb County, which began, the past tense is important here, with the suburb of East Detroit. The suburb was not to be confused with the east side of Detroit, where we lived. It was a separate entity entirely, like East St. Louis. The residents of East Detroit voted in the early 1990s to change the town's name to East Point, hoping that some of the sheen from Lakeshore Drive might rub off on their suburb, composed almost entirely of muffler men and collision shops, by simple virtue of no longer having the syllables Detroit in its name. I knew that the guys with the gun would be headed to the west side, which meant that they would go to 8 Mile, which meant that sooner or later they would need to go right to go left. I knew too that my father, the most tenacious man I've ever met, would tail them every inch of their way. So I switched on my headlights, said a short prayer, and headed straight for 8 Mile, doing my best in my little American four-cylinder to beat them to the anticipated spot. It worked. 10 seconds later, they went whizzing by, first the totally outclassed criminals who would never shake the driver behind them, and then my father, revving the little Renault for all it was worth. The two cars were drifting in tandem to the far side of 8 Mile, preparing to take the turnaround that would direct them back toward the west. Knowing that I had no hope of catching them by following that path, I went left to go right, against the flow of what, hours before sunrise, was the non-existent traffic. When I came out of the turnaround, the criminal's car, which I was now facing, came to a stop, as did my father's car behind them. What now? It'll be interesting, I remember thinking, to see how this one shakes out. It was 3 in the morning, and we were 3 cars at a dead stop on the then East Detroit side of 8 Mile, with one of us, me, facing the wrong way. Come on, fellas, wouldn't it be better to settle this on our home turf on the Detroit side? What next? We all drive east to Grosse Pointe, where they really didn't want to be bothered with this shit at 3 a.m.? I would gladly have gotten out of their way if I could have secured a promise then and there that they would use the next turnaround to return to Detroit, where we all belonged. Such a promise proved unnecessary. A few seconds later, they panicked and plowed their little Japanese import over the curb of the median, slipping and sliding across the grassy island between the eastbound and westbound sides of the boulevard. After briefly bottoming out on the descent, sending sparks skyward, they tore back down the Detroit side street that I'd driven up only moments before. Unwilling to inflict similar damage to our own cars, my father and I took the next turnaround, and the guys with the gun took the opportunity to disappear back inside Detroit's northeast corner, the streets of which I knew much, much better than the back of my hand. We drove around slowly for a bit, looking left and right at intersections, and eventually drifted south towards St. Jude Church on 7 Mile, where my father had gone to grade school and where our family still went to Mass. We always sat in the church's western alcove at Sunday services, in the pew directly behind the votive candles. My sister and I spent the majority of each service picking at melted wax, which burnt our fingertips before it cooled and hardened, blissfully unaware that the flames in front of us had been lit by those in various stages of despair. During Saturday evening services in the fall and winter, your fingers might grow cold gripping your songbook, but look at the light of the low sun reflecting off the stained glass. Forget for a second about the spider webs in the upper reaches of the ceiling and take a minute to appreciate the acoustics in the place. Ignore the stiffness in your joints and the lack of padding on the kneelers, the result of half a century's penitence, and acknowledge that your savior suffered far worse and far less pleasant surroundings. I hadn't lit a candle or even offered up a prayer entirely free of cursing, but St. Jude, the patron saint of the lost cause, answered my petition that night. There up ahead was the criminal's car, abandoned now, having evidently crashed into the parked Crown and Regal on the corner. We would later hear that the car wasn't even theirs, but had been stolen earlier that evening from a house several blocks away. But still, the sight of that totaled car looked to my 16-year-old eyes like victory, for my father and for me and for what I can only call waxing euphemistic our way of life. I'm going to stop that chase there. I have to say that I was pretty proud of that passage. I thought, what a great car chase. And then my wife got on Netflix. I don't know if any of you do Netflix. And she was going through a Steve McQueen phase. So we got Bullet, which has obviously the most famous car chase. And this doesn't live up to that. I can only wish I were Steve McQueen. Sure, my wife feels the same. I don't plan on reading any more of it just because I'm now in about the 16th hour of my day, and I'm and it's not 9:05, but it feels like it. But I'm happy to take questions, and maybe the questions will lead me to a thought about another passage that I can then read. But for the time being, I'm gonna take a little break. Yes. Okay.
I was really curious as to why you did not identify it by name.
Well, I will do so now. The high school is Notre Dame High School, which is now closed. Is that where you went?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Notre Dame High School. And I didn't name it for a couple reasons. The main one being that as I was writing the book, the school was still open. And I don't think that I wrote anything that any of the priests would have found objectionable. But on the off chance that they did, I didn't name it. I've since heard from a number of the priests who've read it, and they've enjoyed it a great deal. So on both counts, I think my reticence was misplaced. But the school closed after I finished going through the proofs of the book.
Did it really last year?
Yeah, I mean, any of you who are from, I don't know if the Detroit papers come up here, but I think in the part, if you all read them, but in the part that was read by Dr. Berg, about church closings, if you've been following it in the last few days, the Archdiocese has done another round of church closings. And I think U of D Jesuit down by the University of Detroit is the only Catholic high school left open in the city of Detroit. And even in the inner ring suburbs, you know, but not everyone else does, that Notre Dame was on the Harper Woods side of Kelly Road. Kelly Road divides Detroit from Harper Woods. So even in the inner ring suburbs, pretty much all of the Catholic schools are closing. And you obviously remember Regina, they're closing their doors and moving out to the suburbs. But I've been, you know, I've respected the priests a great deal. I keep in touch with a great many of them. But I think there's a part of me that's still, they're priests. They still inspire a certain amount of fear and trembling in me. So had there been anything they objected to, I was going to leave that vague. The other reason is aesthetic, and I don't know if I succeeded aesthetically or not, but in the passage I just read, there's an unbelievable amount of specificity about how you get here and there. And my idea, and again, I don't know if I succeeded in doing this or not, was to be very, very specific at the beginning of the book, because my experience there, or the experience that I was trying to capture, which many people shared, was tied to, you'll remember this, others of you from Detroit or maybe from other cities, everything was tied to the schools and the parishes, almost all of which now are gone. You know, you'd say so-and-so lived by St. Jude, so-and-so lived by St. Raymond, so-and-so lived by St. Veronica's. So it was important to me to get all of that very clear and to situate the reader. But I had this idea that maybe I achieved or not, that as the book progressed, it would get a little bit vaguer. You know, obviously the book got attention in Detroit, but for the book to succeed at all, people in Chicago and New York and Philadelphia need to read that too. And, you know, it doesn't matter to them really one way or the other what the name of my grade school or high school was. I did name my grade school because it had closed by that point. But yeah, the aesthetic answer to that question is that I just wanted the experience to go from very specific to try to achieve, and again, I don't know if I did, a certain amount of universality. And by constantly getting bogged down in details of this is here and that is there, I think you lose some of that. So that's the two-part answer to that question. Yes?
I'm just wondering, after you, published your book and it went out to the public and you started getting feedback and so forth, do you have any different sense of what you've written? Has it given you another perspective that you thought, oh, I didn't realize this was going to happen as a result of me writing this? I mean, I just wondered,
Lisa,
and I want to say, I love your father.
I do, too. He wouldn't come to a book reading. You read the book. He's not going to come to a reading.
He's
the best man I've ever known. But the experience, I have nothing to compare it to. It's my first book, so I didn't really know what to expect, and I didn't grow up in a very bookish household. A passage that maybe I'll read that tends to go over well is the list. There's a great literary tradition of lists. I think it begins with Homer and the catalog of ships in the Iliad. And I got a great list in there of all the car magazines my father subscribed to. But anyways, that was the sum total of the reading material in our house. He's not a reader and he wouldn't come to this. But my background is not very literary, so I don't know what to expect. I feel, I've gone to New York for a reading and some interviews, and my publisher sent me to the Miami Book Fair, and I've seen other readers or other writers and met them, and they have a certain polish. You know, a lot of them, they all went to places like Brown and Dartmouth, and they're from mainline Philadelphia, and you know, they have this sort of panache, and I entirely lack it. So I've been intimidated by other writers, and I don't know many, but they seem to know what to expect. I mean, they take these things as they come. The good and the bad. I really didn't know what to expect. I think my thoughts about the book probably have altered, but I think they've altered independent of feedback I've gotten. I don't have much patience for praise, so it means very little to me. I'm glad the New York Times picked it as a notable book. I don't think I would have. It's a pretty average first book. I'm happy if people like it, but. I think I'm aware of its faults, and I think they're manifest when you read it. And I reread it recently for the paperback edition. I'm not trying to achieve some sort of false modesty, but when you begin any undertaking, I think, and it doesn't have to be a book, you have the sort of Platonic ideal of what you're going to achieve. I think people who write have this experience. And then you start putting it down on paper, and you're like, well, that's not bad, not quite there, but, you know, it's not bad. And you all you realize is how short you fell of what you tried to do. And I tend to be pessimistic by nature, I guess. And so my thoughts of the book are that if I wrote it again today, I'd probably write it very differently. But it was the book I had in me at the time I wrote it, and I tried to write it as well as I could. But no, I mean, when I get a good review or someone says they like it, I'm pleased, but it doesn't really change anything, and neither a negative review or a negative response. I spent so much time with it. I lived with it for so many years that I really know its faults. It's like your child, you know, and someone else telling you your kid did this or that. You know better than that person does.
I'm familiar with the area in the book, but in that passage that you read, and in other passages, there's no mention of the law enforcement people. Do they were non-existent at that time? I mean,
no.
You had this car chase, and there was no place where a cop car was involved.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. That's.
So, I mean, it was, in essence, an unpoliced area?
No, I mean, that's not true, but it was, I mean, I think, to back up, my father was... he was a take charge kind of guy, so he wasn't about to wait around for anyone to show up. I mean, I think that's the true answer, and I wouldn't want to extrapolate too much from that. He was going after.
He went after, but yeah. After all this driving around 8 Mile Road and Kelly and whatnot, you didn't come across any police.
No, not to my recollection. It's 3 o'clock. Yeah. Yes.
Love the book, and thank you for coming. I did not perceive it as racist, and I doubt that you did. I actually liked the balance of it, but I'm interested in what your concerns were and how you handled that yourself about the racial dimension of it, and what feedback you're getting on it. Are there people who are upset about the way you handled the racial?
Yeah, I mean, I talked about this with Michael when we did the interview. It's a perfectly legitimate question. I never set out to write a book that dealt with race. I always knew I wanted to write a book about Detroit. And I was born the year Coleman Young was elected. And you can't write a book about Detroit, especially maybe in the second half of the 20th century, without writing about race. So, I mean, I had to write about that. So that's a given. But you can write about it in any sort of way, and I think that's the question you're asking. How do you deal with it? And this is the response I've given to folks when I've been asked that question, which is that a politically correct book about the Detroit in which I was raised would be an awfully short book. It wouldn't be 240 pages. It probably would have trailed off after a couple. I mean, the book is a consideration of all sorts of things. And one of them, and I think it's a perfect question for anyone to ask, and particularly for a white American to ask, is are you a racist, or to what degree? And I think explicitly address that question and that point in the book. And at one point, I think I say, you know, a racist perhaps is what I call myself. And I would say that was in thought exclusively. It was never in deed. You know, there's the Oscar Wilde line about someone who never says a moral thing and never does an immoral thing. I never did anything that could be perceived, but in my thought processes or in my inner dialogue, I mean, that's a legitimate question to ask. What I was trying to get at, I think, is how complicated that question is or can be. I think often, especially when white writers tackle the topic, which is a fraught topic, it's often presented in sort of stark terms. The question is, and this I talked about with Michael a little bit as well, the dynamic into which I was born is in fact a little bit different than what you think of. I mean, I think when people think of race relations, and this is still largely true, you think of a white majority that's in power. And the Detroit into which I was born was a white minority that wasn't in power. That's not a complaint. I wouldn't trade where I was born and when for the world, but I think it's a different perspective. And I think the question of how do you deal with the issue is more complex than it's ever been. And I felt as if my upbringing in the city, this is what I tried to get in the book. The book's sort of a quarrel with myself on these issues. At times I write about when I went to college, and I think this is fairly typical. You know, if you come from a sort of conservative Catholic background, you go to college and you sort of reject all that. And I write about the writers who I sort of fell in love with, is the apt term, writers like James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison and Malcolm X in his autobiography. And you say, you know, these guys are right. This wasn't a perspective I heard in White Detroit, but they have a really legitimate complaint. And so you feel yourself moving a different direction. And then you go back to Detroit and you see things and you say, well, maybe those guys in the barbershop, maybe they had a point. And you feel yourself being pulled in different directions. And I tried to get that on the page. The book, I should also say, has no thesis. There's nothing I'm trying to prove or disprove. What I'm trying to do is track a progress in the way that I just described, where at certain points in my life I felt thus and so, at other points I felt like this, and maybe I didn't like feeling like this, and how do you work through it? I think in a memoir especially, when it's all in the first person and it's all in your head, you know, when you're a young writer, they say you gotta have a conflict. What's the conflict? And I think in a memoir, you know, there's not an antagonist in the book. I'm my own antagonist. And whatever conflict there is between two warring halves of myself, I hope that answer makes some sense. Yes?
I find it interesting in the book how you reflect upon Grosse Pointe, because you're from the East Side of Detroit.
Yeah, yeah.
I dated a girl from Grosse Pointe for 2.5 years now, and I grew up in the Down River area of Detroit. It was a very
working class, yeah.
Area. So I had certain stereotypes about the area as well. And what I wanted to ask you was, how do you feel that you were closed off from the rest of the world growing up in Detroit? And now living in Grosse Pointe, how do you feel? Do you feel like it's a little bit of the same thing? Because Grosse Pointe is so different from everywhere around it.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't feel closed off from the rest of the world living in Detroit. I thought Detroit was the world. That was sort of my parochial. I always say my upbringing was parochial in a couple of senses. The one sense, obviously, the Catholic sense was parochial. But I thought everybody was from the east side of Detroit. I mean, I didn't know. I never left Detroit. I mean, on occasion, we would take a trip during the summer, but I was always to a drag race somewhere. But I mean, I never left. I thought everybody was from, you know, the east side of Detroit. And because that was all I knew. So no, I didn't feel closed off from the world. And as I said, there's no, I hope what comes through in the book, and if it doesn't, I failed miserably, is a real love for the place. I mean, I would not trade where I was born and when for anything. It was the greatest place in the world to grow up. So no, I didn't feel closed off. Has my perspective changed? Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that a question about responses. Someone will say, well, in the book you say thus and so. And I say, well, when I'm writing that, I was 16 years old. I hope I don't think the same things I thought when I was 16. So, yeah, my thought patterns about Detroit and its suburbs have changed a good deal. And, of course, parenthood changes your perspective a great deal. So, yeah, I mean, the answer to that, the second part of your question is, yes, my perspective on all that has altered. I mean, one of the things you learn, I think, is that the world's a lot more complex than you ever thought it was. You know, there's the Twain line that, what is it? When I was 18, my father was the dumbest man I ever knew. And when I was 21, I was amazed to see what the old guy had learned in 3 years. You know, that comment. And yeah, I feel a lot of that. I'm sorry, go on.
You said that you let him have some editorial, if he didn't like something.
I gave the entire manuscript to everyone in my family, so.
And what did he think? What does he think now?
Really there isn't that much. I mean, that's the other thing. Books are sort of published in a vacuum. I mean, there are a few books that get a lot of attention. I'm not being inundated with letters, and I'm not being stopped on the street. You know, I got in here just fine. There was no ruckus. I was more concerned with my father's reaction than I was with the New York Times book reviews. I mean, that's the short answer. I gave it to him, and he's not a reader, first of all. And I mean, I was not going to publish anything or allow to be published anything that bothered people in my family. I remember listening to an interview with one of my idols, Philip Roth, on Terry Gross, and Terry Gross asked Roth a similar question, because Roth has written, he's written one or two memoirs, but he's also written very, very autobiographical fiction. So people tend to think they know his family members the way they're portrayed fictionally. So she asked him that question, and Roth sort of punted, and he answered it by quoting somebody else. I don't remember who it was, a poet, I believe. But anyways, the response was that, well, when a writer is born into a family, that family is finished. You know, I hope that's not true, and I don't have the same belief in the wonder and the primacy of art that it trumps all other considerations. If people in my family objected strenuously, I would have called it off. But he didn't, and he said it strikes me as sort of, you know, this is the way it was, and that's how we were, and he had no problem with it. But I think some of that, because, again, when you don't come from a family where books are a big deal, it's hard to imagine people reading it. You know what I mean? It doesn't quite get through. And that's true for me as well. I mean, I didn't quite know what it was going to be like. But anyway, so he read it, and he came over. I went over to my parents' house. I don't remember which. And I said, so, Pop, what do you think? And he thought, that was good. And I'm like, you know, care to amplify that response? Like, well, I learned a new word. I said, why? He said, well, you sent me running to the dictionary a couple times. I was like, well, what's the new word you learned? And he said, elegiac, which is a term I used in there once. And I don't know, did they do words of the day when you were there?
They do.
Words of the day at Notre Dame, the high school. Did they use?
You know, I've just been thinking about how to frame an answer to that. Because I came from only because the GI Bill of Rights, it was still a very working class kind of family, although we were told the books were important. I'm not sure they always believed that, but books became important to me, and I spent many, many hours in that Notre Dame library, because I had to wait 2 or 3 hours after school every day for a ride, and I was no job. And you were a really smart guy, and I think you tried to think hard about these questions. When I heard about this book, I read about it at East Lansing Public Library. Now, I moved away from Macomb County 31 years ago. Mm-hmm. I came to go to school here, never left, because I wanted to be around books and around people with ideas. In a lot of ways, this town has horrifically disappointed me. But
Which East Lansing?
East Lansing, yeah. But I looked to your book, Insight, Answers, and Hope. The most polite thing I can say is that you're still young, and you're still thinking, and you say you're still changing, because I found the book regrettable, because it didn't give much insight, it gave no answers, and it gave no hope.
Well, I mean, first of all, the question I asked was if they had words of the day. And the word...
They didn't have words of the day, but they taught us to think.
Yeah, but
one thing that the priests at Notre Dame did, they would try to teach you to think, they would try to make you think outside the box. And people in the Detroit metro area, white people, were stuck in a box. And black people got stuck in a box because of Coleman Young. And unlike any other metropolitan region in this country, they got stuck in these two boxes, and it just... Let's just say I consider the whole southeastern part of Michigan to be a horrific tragedy in motion that can only get worse.
Then how would my book have given you any hope? If that's what we feel. Anyways, the point...
Has given me hope?
Yeah.
It's given some answers. I think you need to take a more historical approach. And I think, you know, one of the things that surprised me when I came here and I took a class in political science, they spent so much time on economics. I thought, what does economics have to do with democracy and rights and things like that? You know what? 30 years later, I'll tell you, it has everything. And I'm not sure that you caught on to that.
Okay, I'm going to... thank you. So my father learned the, and I'm going to address some of what you just said in a moment, but one of the things my father said was, I learned a new word, elegiac, and that was one of the words of the day. And if you've read the book, we had 720 words we had to learn, every one for every day of our 4 years, and elegiac comes from the word elegy, which means a sort of valedictory or farewell. So that was the word he learned, and that was basically the sum and total of his response to the manuscript. The point you raise is a good one. I mean, sometimes you get criticized, going back to feedback, for the book you didn't write. I wasn't writing an economic book. I wasn't writing a history book. It's a memoir. I tried to give a certain amount of history to contextualize the experience for people not from Detroit. But if you want a history of Detroit, there's shelves in the library full of them, and I cite some of them in the back of the book. But the point you make, I have gotten from others. And one of the first reviews I saw was in Entertainment Weekly. And I was surprised to see it in Entertainment Weekly. And the reviewer gave me a B. If you know Entertainment Weekly, they give you an A, B, C, D, or F. And they do that for books and CDs and movies. And my first response, being a Catholic school kid, was, you know, there goes my 4 point. But the reviewer said a lot of what you just said. She used a lot of very nice adjectives that probably the book doesn't warrant. But what she said, and it's a very short review, it's 100, 150 words, was that it's clear Clemens hasn't come close to finding answers. And there's something to be said for that, and I think that's true. And I'm not denying it. My response to that is what I was trying to do was, and if I don't know if this makes sense or not, was give shape to my own confusion. To give some artistic shape to the tensions I felt in myself, which grew out of the tensions of the region, which you aptly described. And to try to give a more realistic or accurate, at least in my case accurate, sense of this, that I often feel that when people talk about class issues or racial issues, they tend to take a tone of certainty that at least I don't usually feel, and that sometimes I don't know is entirely warranted. So what I was trying to do was not to come up with answers. And it's perfectly legitimate to criticize a book for not doing what you think it should have done. All I can say to that is that that wasn't my intention as I wrote it. Yes?
I'm just wondering, are there any passages that illustrate the relationships that you or your family might have had with African Americans, or maybe, barriers that presented, having strong relationships?
Yeah, I mean, I tried in the beginning of the book to talk about the brother and sister. Have you read it? Okay, well, I'll recap some of it for and boring to those who have. The first part of the book is, I think, a chapter called 6 Mile. And my sister and I's best friends were a black brother and sister who lived down the block, so I write about them a good deal. And there's an entire chapter set on a football team that I played on where it was other black kids and Heilman Field, which was the park by my house where I would skate in the winter when there was a ice rink frozen and I'd play basketball in the summer. And I was usually the only white kid or one of the only white kids there. So all of that is in the book. I write about a friend of mine during college who was the RA in my dorm who I formed an attachment with. So that sort of thing's all through the book. And it's all through the book, I should say, not for simply because that's the way it was. It's not there for me to sort of hide behind to say, look, I had black friends. Don't attack me. It's because that's the way it was. But yeah, that's all there. And if you read the book, I hope you enjoy it, and you'll see some of that.
I promised Paul we'd get him home early tonight, so I think we'll call it an evening.
Thank you.